You are Locked On Seahawks, your daily Seattle Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Greetings, 12. This is Corbin Smith, your host for Locked On Seahawks. Rejoining me for our Tuesday show, my co-host in crime, Rob Rang. Glad to have you listening in. Whether this is your first time listening to Locked On Seahawks or you're a regular listener, glad to have you tuning in. It's going to be a jam-packed episode. We're going to break down the latest from Seahawks OTAs. They wrapped up their eighth practice today at the VMAC. Plus, we're going to continue our 90-player countdown with numbers 70 through 66. Make sure to check out Locked On's Peacock and Williamson every Monday through Friday. NFL analyst Brian Peacock and former NFL scout Matt Williamson give you the national perspective all around the NFL, covering all the latest news and insight on every game, team, and move around the NFL. Get your picks, previews, and much more every weekday with the Peacock and Williamson podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Now for your lead story here on Locked On Seahawks. It's been a big storyline the last 48 hours. The Seahawks have had a bunch of their veteran players fly into town to begin participating in their OTA sessions. Up to this point, the Seahawks have had less than 40 players participating. It's really been an extension of rookie minicamp, mostly draft picks and undrafted rookies out there getting snaps, which obviously is a big deal for those players because they've never played in the NFL before. But Russell Wilson, Bobby Wagner, and DK Metcalf headlined the veterans that showed up for OTA starting yesterday. They've participated in the last two practices. But really, this time of year, especially in post-COVID circumstances, it's really difficult to glean much from these practices. It was only a 40-minute session today. No 11-on-11 or 7-on-7 drills. Defense was going against defensive players. Sorry, but it's hard to gain much when you have your corners covering Aaron Doncor as the wide receiver. But that's the way that OTAs are functioning right now in our post-COVID-19 climate. And so not a lot of chances really glean notable observations from these practices, but there were two players on the field today that have been battling injuries. They were back in action today, the most notable being Marquise Blair. His return from a torn ACL, that is a big deal for the Seahawks heading into the 2021 season.
Oh, it's huge. I mean, that's the thing, is that just seeing him back on the field is exciting. I mean, the fact that he is able to move fluidly, accelerate and change directions, that's absolutely critical. And, you know, I think that is one of the big storylines here that is going to get, I think a little bit overshadowed by the fact that Russell Wilson was on the field, as you mentioned, DK Metcalf and Bobby Wagner, all of that. You know, some of the players that, you know, there have been some speculation is obviously with Russell Wilson, whether or not that he was going to be back this season and all that kind of stuff. You can kind of just wipe all that away. It felt like it was a little bit more of a return to normal. I think that you're right to kind of focus in on Marquise Blair coming off of that injury, Akilah Witherspoon coming over from the 49ers, who also had an offseason, relatively minor surgery in comparison to Blair's ACL. To me, that's the big news here. Obviously, again, Russell Wilson being there in person and being able to acclimate to the new Shane Waldron's new offense, all of that is big. But, you know, it's by design that the Seahawks aren't going to be, you know, laying their cards out there for the media to kind of see everything that Shane Waldron is looking to do. That was one of the things that DK Metcalf kind of was chuckling about in the post-practice interviews, is that while the Waldron's offense is intricate, he talked about how the routes are a little bit more, a little bit different type of routes or route combinations. And at the same time, the fact that you just mentioned, Corbin, that Seattle was basically lining up one of their linebackers and a very raw linebacker in that, in Aaron Doncor at wide receiver, basically tells you about how much that the Seahawks are going to be willing to show the media and everybody else at this early stage of their of the OTA practices.
And there are obviously limitations on these practices to begin with. Now, I've seen other teams, other reporters are showing this stuff, that there are teams that are doing 11-on-11 work and their offense is going against the defense. The Seahawks did not do that, at least today. Who knows if they will be doing that the last couple OTA practices. I fully anticipate in mandatory minicamp they will be doing that. But I don't have any specific observations to give on what the offense is going to look like because there really wasn't anything to glean. But I can tell you that Marquise Blair, one of the things I was looking for, I saw number 27 out there on the field with his helmet on. I saw him running around. Being a secondary player coming off that torn ACL, for me, the big thing to always look for a player coming off the injury is how well does he change directions? How comfortable is he changing directions? And Blair did not look hindered at all to me when they were doing back pedal drills, when he was working one-on-ones against other corners and safeties, when he was chasing after the football. He was cutting on a dime. He was easily getting out of his breaks. Didn't look like he was coming off of a severe knee injury. And we still got a little under 2 months until training camp. So if he's not 100%, he sure looks like he's close right now. If he's not quite there at this point, I fully anticipate that he's going to be ready for the start of training camp to compete against Uhuamadi to get that starting nickel job back that he ended up losing after week two when he suffered that injury. And Akello Witherspoon coming back, I will say this right now. You're not going to be able to gain too much watching him in coverage against his fellow cornerbacks. I want to see him go up against DK Metcalf. I want to see him go up against Tyler Lockett. I want to see him go up against Dwayne Eskridge. Until he's gone against some of those players, I really can't evaluate where he's going to fit into Seattle secondary, but he's every bit of 6'3", and he doesn't run. He glides. He's got long strides. He gallops, and he just takes up so much space in such quick order. And it was a pleasure to watch him even just doing drill work today. You can see why the Seahawks were enamored by him, even though he's been inconsistent in San Francisco his first four NFL seasons. You can see the length, you can see the ball skills, and you can see the athleticism. So I would be very surprised if he is not one of the front runners to earn a starting job in that secondary. He's going to have to win that position, but he looks every bit like the type of player the Seahawks love to have at that cornerback spot. So it was encouraging seeing him and Marquise Blair both out there healthy, running well. That's big news for the Seahawks with training camp quickly approaching.
We all realize how much the Seattle secondary struggled early on last year, and you lost your best cornerback in Shaquille Griffin going to the Jacksonville Jaguars. So how is Seattle going to be able to improve that? We talked about, or we know, of course, that Seattle was able to address their pass rush with the trade for Jamal Adams, the trade for Carlos Dunlap. The way that Seattle's defense built itself up a year ago is encouraging. But, yeah, I very much expect Witherspoon to be if not a starter, then to be challenging for a starting position. And I think that he has the highest upside of Seattle's corners that are still on the roster. I remain a fan of Trey Flowers. We saw what DJ Reed was able to do. Some of the young players I think are really intriguing. But Witherspoon, to me, is the best combination of a guy who's already proven that he can play at the NFL level, at a starting NFL level, and yet still has a little bit of that untapped potential. So, to me, I'm really excited about that. And then, again, I think that we already know a little bit, Corbin, about what Shane Waldron's offense is going to look like, kind of going back to what I was mentioning before, just because we know the types of players that Seattle brought in. The fact that they did make the selection of Dwayne Eskridge just kind of leads you to believe that they're going to be doing some of those fly sweeps. They're going to be doing a lot of those shallow kind of crossers that the Rams had used before. The fact that you made the trade for Gabe Jackson, the big burly offensive lineman, that kind of throws out that idea that it's just going to be a bunch of pass protection and Seattle's going to lose their identity of who they used to be with running the football right down team's throats. You bring back Ethan Postick and don't bring a lot of competition for him at the center position. To me, it's you'd like to go to the OTAs. You'd like to be able to see some things that to be able to develop some new kind of thoughts on what the team might look like. But I think that if we already know what the players look like physically, you mentioned the injuries that Blair and Witherspoon are coming off of. We know the scheme. We know the types of players, and we know the past, that what Pete Carroll has always prioritized in the past. To me, that's what we're getting out of these OTAs, and where Seahawks fans can feel pretty confident about what the club is going to look like moving forward.
plenty of positive vibes coming out of this practice, even though I don't think there's a lot to glean from these OTAs in terms of substance. Still really good news for the team moving forward. When we come back in the second quarter, we're going to continue our 2020 season in retrospect here on Throwback Tuesday. We're going to be looking back at Week 10 and Week 11 from the 2020 season, Seattle's road loss to the Rams, as well as a bit of redemption against the Cardinals at Lumen Field. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day. With the ever-increasing numbers of makes and models, it is now impossible to stock all the parts you need in a traditional chain storefront. Why endure often pointless or seemingly intimidating questioning and wait while the counterman orders the parts on his computer, choosing the only brand his warehouse happens to carry? You have computers with access to rockauto.com and in your pocket. RockAuto.com is a family business serving auto parts customers online for 20 years. Go to RockAuto.com to shop for auto and body parts from hundreds of manufacturers. Best of all, prices at RockAuto.com are always reliably low, and the same for professionals and do-it-yourselfers. Why spend up to twice as much for the same parts? Go to RockAuto.com right now and see all the parts available for your car and truck. Write "Locked On" in their "How Did You Hear About Us" box so they know we sent you. Amazing selection. Reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need, rockauto.com. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to bet on all your sports action. Baseball season is in full swing, and you can track all the action at BetOnline. Get all the latest news, odds, and info for all your sporting needs, including Major League Baseball, the NBA, NHL, and all of the UFC MMA action. Before the next pitch, head over to BetOnline on your laptop or mobile device and check out all the great sporting news, sign-up bonuses, and contest information. Don't sit on the sidelines anymore, as this is your chance to get into the game as teams prep for their runs to the playoffs. Head to the website or use your mobile device to sign up today and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast. I'm your host, Corbin Smith, joined as always by Rob Rang. It's Throwback Tuesday. We're going to continue our 2020 in retrospect series, looking back at all of Seattle's games from last season. We are now past the midway point, heading into Week 10, and this was an area where the Seahawks were really scuffling. They're coming off a 44-34 loss to the Bills, which we recapped last week on the show. And now they're on the road again playing the Rams, who are right step in step with the Seahawks atop the NFC West at this point. Los Angeles has been a place that Seattle has really struggled to win games in recent years. And unfortunately, that trend continued, though it was not because of a slow start. This game actually started pretty well in Seattle's favor. They did give up a field goal the opening drive, but then they marched right down the field, and Alex Collins punched it in from 13 yards out, and suddenly it was 7-3. It felt like the Seahawks had some momentum early in this game, and unfortunately, we didn't really see the offense muster much the rest of the game. Russell Wilson really struggled once again, three more turnovers, and they ended up finishing the game with just 16 points. Really, Jason Myers was the bulk of their offense in this game.
He really was. I mean, I think you could argue that he was the player of the game for Seattle. And that's I mean that in kind of a chuckle because Seattle struggled in this game, and you'd rather not have your kicker be the player of the game. But he did make a 61-yard field goal, the longest in Seattle history. So that certainly deserves some acknowledgement. And as you mentioned, Corbin, Seattle scored 16 points. Nine of them were from his leg. So, you know, give the man some credit. But I think the bigger story here is, as you mentioned, Seattle was coming off of that loss against Buffalo. Then they lose their second straight, losing to the Rams. And so it's starting to be a little bit of panic, you know, because they're Russell Wilson had started off the season so hot. And yet in this game, he does not throw a touchdown. He had struggled with throwing interceptions against Buffalo. It has the same thing against Arizona. Three turnovers, as you mentioned, two interceptions. And the first interception I thought was a particularly bad one. You might remember he's kind of rolling to his right, looks back over. It looked like he had an easy first down run that he could have ran for 10, 15 yards. And instead, he decides to throw back against the grain and throw off the ball up, and that gets intercepted. And so to me, those are the types of decisions that you saw Russell Wilson start to make later on, or at least in the midpoint of this season, where it just felt like he was pressing a little bit. Maybe he was reading a little bit of his own press clippings and was starting to kind of buy into this hype of let Russell cook. And and possibly being the MVP favorite at that point. But this is when things started to really get a little bit scary from the Seahawks fans, because the Rams, kind of took Seattle's lunch. I mean, they were the more physical team. We saw the same thing wind up happening, in the postseason, unfortunately, from a Seattle perspective. And it wasn't just Russell Wilson. It was the fact that the Seattle's offensive line was getting beaten up at the point of attack, because, again, you have public enemy number one from a Seahawks fan and Aaron Donald, who he and Leonard Floyd were absolutely wreaking havoc.
Yeah, Aaron Donald had 3 quarterback hits in this game. Leonard Floyd had 5 and 3 sacks. It felt like Leonard Floyd was sacking Russell Wilson every single time that he dropped back. And you mentioned it, the interception. It's not just the fact that Wilson was throwing picks. He was throwing uncharacteristic picks. And this was like the 3rd game in a row that he had done that, or 3rd time in 4 games, where he was not just getting picked, he was making ill-advised decisions with the football, which I was screaming this back in November and December, that it really did seem like he was just trying to do too much. He was trying to force the issue, maybe playing a little bit of hero ball. And that was the prime example, because Will Dissly was actually open for a little while, but Wilson initially missed him. And by the time he had rolled out to his right and decided, you know what, I'm going to sling the ball across my body and throw it 30 yards downfield, you had Darius Williams all over Dissly at that point. There was no way that ball was going to get completed. Your worst case scenario is that it's going to be an incompletion that's batted down, and it ended up getting picked off. And Williams has had Wilson's number, but again, he could have just tucked the ball and ran for 10, 15 yards, picked up the first down, and he tried to do too much. And we saw that time and time again in this game. There were plays he got sacked on where he could have unloaded the football, and he held on to it and held on to it and held on to it. These were the trends that we saw in the second half that really dogged this offense. But if you're looking for a silver lining from this game, the defense really struggled once again in the first half. The Rams scored 17 points in the first half. But after halftime, something really started to click. Jamal Adams started to look comfortable on defense, made some big hits, and was able to get to Jared Goff a couple of times. Carlos Dunlap was wreaking havoc. They got some interior pressure. Suddenly the secondary was buttoning things up, and the Rams just were not able to move the ball very well. They scored only 6 points in the second half. They kept Seattle in this game throughout those final 2 quarters and gave Russell Wilson opportunity after opportunity to go win the game. He unfortunately wasn't able to do it, but this really was that building block that got Seattle's defense playing at the level we saw them for the last 6 or 7 weeks, where they were among league leaders in points allowed, and they were getting after quarterbacks consistently. They were creating turnovers. This defense went from being one of the worst in the league to suddenly being a strength, and thank goodness it did, because the offense wasn't anything like it was the first 2 months.
No, it really wasn't. And a big part of that is the fact that DK Metcalf wasn't able to get very much involved in this game. I think that he wound up having just 2 catches in this game for just 28 yards. Of course, he was being locked down by Jalen Ramsey for much of this game. But I like that you mentioned the way that Seattle's defense was starting to, just improve. You get 3 sacks on Jared Goff. The Rams' leading rusher in this game was Cam Akers with 38 total yards. They really did shut down the Rams' offense. It's just that Seattle's offense wasn't able to get much going. They were just so helter-skelter. There's so many opportunities. This was it felt like such a very winnable game. And the fact that Seattle wasn't able to come through when it needed to was one of the more frustrating. To me, this was one of the more frustrating games from a Seahawk perspective all season long.
Good news is they were going to bounce back. They were facing the prospect of losing 3 consecutive games, which is just unheard of in the Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson era. And they've got a red-hot Cardinals team coming out to Lumen Field in Week 11. They lost to the Cardinals a few weeks earlier in overtime, a game the Seahawks should have won. They were able to get a bit of revenge. And what I liked about this game, and I know there have been reports that have come out since, that there was growing tension between Pete Carroll, the coaching staff, and Russell Wilson about the way the offense was being orchestrated and leaning more on the run game. But to me, that was one of the big reasons they were able to get back in the win column, because Russell Wilson had thrown so many interceptions in the previous couple games that Pete Carroll needed to intervene a little bit. He needed to step in and say, let's get this run game going. Let's help our quarterback, and then we can get him back on track. And hopefully the decision-making is better, and we can get the quarterback we had the first 2 months of the season to come back. That never quite materialized, but they got a really good performance from Carlos Hyde, nearly 80 rushing yards in this game and a touchdown. They were able to keep Russell Wilson clean for the most part. The Cardinals got a little pressure on him, but he completed 23 of 28 passes, only 197 yards, but two touchdowns, and most importantly, no interceptions. And that was crucial in this game because the Cardinals kept trying to make things interesting in the second half. They cut the lead down to 23 to 21 in the early portion of the fourth quarter, but in the end, the Seahawks were able to make the plays they needed to win on both sides of the ball, namely LJ Collier getting that crucial holding penalty on former Seahawk J.R. Sweezy near the end zone, and that led to a safety, ended up helping the Seahawks hold on for a 7-point win that was critical to eventually winning this division.
Yeah, a lot of things that you just mentioned that I 100% agree with. Collier's, the safety being called, it's a Collier's pressure that led to that. That was critical. Russell Wilson not throwing interceptions. Seattle didn't have any turnovers at all in that game. The pass protection was much better. Wilson was sacked three times, but again, he had been sacked five times the week before by just one player. And the Arizona Cardinals are a team that is absolutely loaded with talent. So that was a significant improvement as well. And one of the things I loved about it is, as I was just mentioning before, in that Rams game, Corbin, how give the Rams credit, give Jalen Ramsey a lot of credit that they were able to shut down DK Metcalf. And so for the Seahawks to come out swinging in this game against the Arizona Cardinals with their very first touchdown being a 25-yard pass from Russell Wilson to DK Metcalf, it just kind of set the needle back to where it should be from a Seattle perspective. Again, if you have a wide receiver who is as dominant as DK Metcalf is, a quarterback who is as talented as Russell Wilson's, especially in the deep ball, then you just absolutely have to go back to that, go back to them. And for Seattle to target Metcalf early on and get that big play, I think just kind of restored that swagger that Seattle has had typically when they're playing against the Cardinals.
Yeah, and they've actually had their issues winning at home against Arizona. Even when the Cardinals won three games a few years back and they had Josh Rosen at quarterback, they gave the Seahawks fits on their home field. And so to be able to get that win against a much improved Cardinals squad, it really was critical towards their goal of getting back to the top of the NFC West, which they eventually did. To me, the player of the game here, Carlos Dunlap, had the crucial fourth down sack at the end of the game. He had two sacks in the game. From a performance standpoint, he would be the selection, but I also got to give kudos to Damian Lewis because this is the game where they still didn't have Ethan Posick, who had been out the last couple weeks with a concussion. Kyle Fuller was dealing with a high ankle sprain. He dressed, but he was not healthy enough to start. So they turned to Lewis, who had never played a down of center in his life in a game. And he held up through four quarters, which is why you and I have speculated he still might end up moving there at some point. Doesn't look like that's going to happen this season, but major kudos to Damian Lewis, and he played a crucial role in what turned out to be a key win for the Seahawks in their road to winning the division and getting back to the postseason.
A really good point. Yeah, Damian Lewis's transition over to center I thought was absolutely critical in this game. And, I gave DK Metcalf a little bit of credit. Let's give his Pro Bowl running mate, Tyler Lockett, some credit. 9 catches on 9 targets in this game. You can't get any more efficient than that. He also had a touchdown. So, again, I thought this was a game where Seattle really kind of, showed who they were, showed that they do have the best quarterback in the division. They do have the best wide receivers in the division. And that's with all due respect to DeAndre Hopkins, Arizona has, and Kyler Murray, all that kind of stuff. But still, Seattle flexed a little bit back at home in this game and kind of took over their spot as the front runner in the NFC West.
When we return for the third quarter, we're going to continue our 90-man roster countdown with numbers 70 through 66, a couple of undrafted rookies that we'll be looking at, plus a couple of returning second-year players that are going to be trying to get onto the 53-man roster after spending most of last year on the practice squad. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Are you looking for a way to boost your workout game? Are you seeking a delicious protein bar without the sugar and carbs enter in the Built Bar, 18 amazing flavors, including nut and non-nut flavors. Some of the best ones, caramel brownie, cookies and cream, apple almond crisp, peanut butter, double chocolate. You're going to have a tough time eating just one. These bars are covered in 100% chocolate, soft, easy to chew. It's great for the health conscious guy. Lose or maintain weight while indulging in a delicious treat. Bars are low calorie, low sugar, high protein, high fiber, and they're great for a keto diet. Remember to use the promo code LOCKED15 to get 15% off your order. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, Tuesday edition. I'm your host, Corbin Smith, joined as always by Rob Rang. It's hard to believe, but we're already getting into the 60s on our 90-player countdown. We will be adding a player to the mix here tomorrow on our countdown. The Seahawks have made a few roster moves over the last 24 hours, but several familiar names we're going to be looking at today, a couple players that have been with the Seahawks in their practice squad for at least a year, and a couple of incoming undrafted rookies that are going to be vying for roster spots as well. So without further ado, let's kick things off. Number 70 on our list, a player that there was so much optimism surrounding John Ursua when he was drafted in the seventh round 2 years ago by the Seahawks, a player that led the nation in receiving touchdowns at Hawaii as a senior, ends up getting picked after the Seahawks traded back in the seventh round. He was supposed to be a slot specialist, but unfortunately, after spending most of his rookie season on the practice squad, only playing in three games, last year, he didn't dress for a single game for the Seahawks. He was beaten out for a roster spot by Penny Hart, who ended up dressing for 13 games. No receptions, no snaps in the regular season for Ursua. And now 27 years old, it feels like this could be his last opportunity to make this roster.
And it really might be, you know, and life comes at you fast. I think when John Ursua was drafted, you know, remember, you know, Seattle traded back into the draft to select him. As you mentioned, he was coming off of a year in Hawaii where he led the entire country in touchdown receptions. And when you watch him on tape, Corbin, the way he can kind of dip his shoulders and kind of sell routes and the cat quickness that he demonstrates getting in and out of his breaks. I mean, you really did see some flashes of kind of Doug Baldwin's route running acumen. We just haven't seen the same type of production, the same type of durability, frankly, the same type of grit that Doug Baldwin had demonstrated throughout his spectacular career in Seattle. And so I think that we're seeing the way the NFL is changing. It used to be that you could be a slot receiver that relied on quickness and toughness and reliable hands. I think Ursua has all those things. He just doesn't have that breakaway straight line speed. And over the last couple of years, I think that we're seeing that the NFL is just relying so much more on guys who can make one player miss and then go the distance. And that's never been Ursua's game. It is Dwayne Eskridge's game. So I agree with you, Corbin. I think that John Ursua has to play the best football of his life if he's going to wind up making Seattle's roster.
What has been really problematic for him each of his first two seasons, his rookie year, he struggled learning the playbook. This last season, he wasn't able to really stand out on special teams. And that's why a player like Penny Hart is going to end up taking your roster spot, because Penny Hart made some tackles on kick and punt coverage. He can return punts and kicks. And quite frankly, he had a better training camp as a receiver than Ursua did. So it wasn't a surprise to me when they made that swap and ended up cutting Ursua and bringing Penny Hart onto the active roster. And they kept it that way for most of the season. Ursua has to be able to show that he can contribute on special teams. And if he's not able to do that, I just don't see him being a good enough receiver where he's going to be able to just get by on those merits alone. It's really tough to win a fourth or fifth or even a sixth receiver spot on an NFL roster if you're just a receiver and you don't have any special teams value. Freddie Swain offers special teams value. Penny Hart does. Cody Thompson has played some special teams. A couple of the players that have been signed as undrafted rookies like Kay Johnson have played special teams. And so the odds are stacked against him if he's not able to show that he can contribute in that capacity. And so that's going to be the key for him in training camp to me. It's not how well he's running routes out of the slot. It's can you contribute in other ways to help this football team and justify keeping you on the roster? To this point, he has not been able to do that. Now, coming in next on our countdown, number 69, incoming undrafted rookie, maybe one of my favorite incoming undrafted rookies the Seahawks signed, especially when you consider that Ethan Posick only has 1 year on his new contract. He'll be a free agent again next season. They could still be in the lookout for a long-term option at that center position. Pierre-Olivier Lestage coming from the University of Montreal. We have to see how he handles this huge step up in competition. OTAs are not going to provide anything in that regard. We need to see what he looks like actually blocking people in training camp in August before we really know where he fits into this team's plans. But they're using him at guard right now primarily. Pete Carroll has said center's an emergency thing right now. But I have to believe with his background, the best chance he has for making this team is if they decide to make him a center full-time. And I expect at some point, maybe even during camp, that that's what the Seahawks are going to end up doing with this kid.
I think they could, and I would agree with you. That is a bigger need for Seattle is to have some type of competition at the center position. I mean, not only is it Posick, but, you know, Brad Lemblade is back on the roster as well, Kyle Fuller. But still, it feels like Lestage's best opportunity, anybody's best opportunity of making this roster would be to show that positional versatility that we just kind of talked about with John Ursua. He has to show the ability to make an impact on special teams. I like Lestage's power. Based on watching him on what he did at the University of Montreal, the little bit of tape that I've seen, talking to some scouts there in the CFL who were kind of hoping that he would be available to them. They also saw him as a little bit better as a guard candidate just because he is not the lightest on his feet, especially in the, you know, kind of a little bit more of if you're going to ask Seattle to kind of do some zone blocking and things like that they've done in the past. It's going to be interesting to see if he's able to make that transition. But in terms of just moving people at the point of attack, that's really what does stand out on his college tape. But as you just mentioned, Corbin, there's not much you can get out of these OTAs and things like that until we actually get into training camp where he's has to physically move some bodies. That's where we're going to see if Lestage is going to have the power to compete at guard or if he's going to have the savviness to be able to make that transition to center as well.
He's got longtime NFL offensive line coach Paul Alexander in his corner as a supporter. That's enough for me to be intrigued right there on its own. I'm a big fan. I have a lot of respect for Paul Alexander. So if he thinks Lestage can get it done, I think that he has the chance to maybe be a sleeper at the right position. To me, center is ultimately where he ends up, and that gives him the best chance to compete for a roster spot or even a practice squad position for the Seahawks. Next up at number 68, this is a player that last year at this time, you were pretty intrigued by him coming out of Stony Brook, and that's Gavin Heslop, cornerback. He spent most of training camp injured, but the Seahawks still kept him on their practice squad, a player they're very intrigued by. He's got good size, very technically sound, a good tackler. The one big question mark that I still have about him, he had no interceptions in college, not a lot of passes defense. Some of it is that the teams at the FCS level were not testing him because he was easily the best corner on the field, and in many cases the best corner in his conference. So teams didn't test him very often, but his ball skills still look like an area that I think is questionable, and with the additions they've made at that position, I think that he's got a tall task ahead of him to get under this roster and maybe even make the practice squad. There's a lot of competition now at that cornerback spot.
There is a lot of competition, but yeah, Heslop's one of my guys that I've liked for a long time. You know, he was one of my diamond in the rough type of players. You know, it's funny, ever since Pete Carroll took over as Seattle's head coach, I know everybody talks about the 32-inch arms, but to me, when you at the cornerback position, you have to be able to tackle. That's been one of the things that has just been an absolute requirement of Pete Carroll's defense. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there that's like, well, that's a requirement for any cornerback at any level. It is, but it's not. I mean, I've seen a million teams out there who prioritize just, you know, man-to-man cover skills or straight line speed or ball skills, as you mentioned. But it just feels like with Seattle, they focus so much on those corners being able to make just clean open field tackles. And that's where Heslop really does stand out. In fact, so much so that I've talked to scouts out there who thought that maybe he should be making that transition to safety. Seattle, of course, has bounced around with lots of different defensive backs who've been able to play that corner and that safety spot. You know, and so to me, that's one of the things that is very intriguing about Heslop. I think that he does have to make some plays on the football to be able to make this roster. But again, I do like his upside. I do like his grit. Man, I like his size, 6 foot, 197 pounds. I mean, he is a big, strong, physical guy at that cornerback spot. And again, the positional versatility that I think that he provides you, not only being able to play on the outside, I think that he might be able to slide inside, maybe even be able to play back in the safety position and special teams as well. It's that type of positional versatility. I think he's going to be a hard guy to get off this roster.
Next player up on our list at number 67, very similar circumstances to Heslop a year ago, and that's Tommy Champion, former offensive lineman out of Mississippi State. Never was really a full-time starter at the college level, a very raw player coming into the NFL, but he did some nice things on the practice field last year in training camp. He spent the entire season on Seattle's practice squad. He's got good size. From what I've been told, he's a player that they are encouraged by his development to this point. The addition of Stone Forsythe, as well as the undrafted rookie in Jake Curran, I think makes it much tougher now for Tommy Champion to have a shot at making this team, especially with having Cedric Oboehi re-signing as well. There's just a lot of bodies at that tackle position, some good young players they brought in. Maybe he can still hold out hope for a practice squad spot. But I think of these two players, even compared to Heslop, I think the Champion is going to be in a potentially impossible situation trying to stick on this roster, even get back onto the practice squad. He might be a player that his best bet is to put some good tape out there for other teams to consider adding him to their roster after he gets waived. I don't like speaking pessimistically that way, but to me, that's the outlook for Tommy Champion with the additions they have made at the tackle position.
Well, I have to agree with you in the one regard that definitely Seattle has built up its offensive line significantly in this offseason. Not only with the trades we mentioned for Gabe Jackson and things like that, but, of course, in the draft and undrafted free agency, Jim Nagy, the Senior Bowl senior executive, he had kind of talked about Curran as being a player that he was really, really high on as well. So I think those are all really good points. However, There's very few clubs out there who are willing to gamble on traits as much as Seattle, and 6'5", 320 pounds, and just moving the way that Tommy Champion does, not only with his feet, but with his power as well. The test results are one thing, and then when you watch him on tape, you see some flashes. Now, there's definitely some inconsistency issues here. This is a player that was a super highly regarded prep player coming out of Mississippi, signed with the Mississippi State Bulldogs, and then had some academic issues, forcing him to go the JUCO route. He goes back to Mississippi State, and they had a bunch of NFL guys ahead of him. So I think that this is one of those guys that the Seattle is willing to kind of roll the dice and just see if they can develop him. You mentioned the offensive line coach, Paul Alexander. I'm a big fan of him. I'm a big fan of some of the offensive line coaches that Seattle has as well. And if they believe in Tommy Champion, then I think that, that it's going to be interesting to see what he's able to do in his second year in the program.
Finishing off our cluster of players today, this is the one you and I were both most excited to talk about today, because Tamorian Terry, this is at least my opinion. After the 2019 season at Florida State, he had over 1,000 receiving yards, had a monster season for a Seminoles team that wins loss-wise did not do very well. It's been a struggling program, but he had an outstanding season on an individual level. It looked to me like this was a guy that was probably going to be a mid-round pick at worst, and maybe he could play his way into day two because he's 6'3", over 200 pounds, he can jump out of a building, 4.4 speed. He's got a lot of the traits that you see out of receivers that get picked pretty early in the draft, and yet his last season at Florida State did not go well. He had injuries. He had drop issues. He did not play near as well as he did the season before, and there's questions about his durability. All those things considered, he went undrafted. The Seahawks plucked him up as a priority free agent very quickly, though. I've been told that this is one of their top targets at any position group they wanted to sign as an undrafted free agent. And if you can get the 2019 version of this kid, then I absolutely think he could make players like Freddie Swain start sweating a little bit, because this guy's got a ton of talent, and I think he might be able to contribute some on special teams as well. With his size, you add all these factors together, he is one of the most intriguing undrafted players the Seahawks brought in this year.
Absolutely is. I mean, he literally, quite literally, is head and shoulders among most of the receivers that are on Seattle's roster. And it's interesting that you mentioned Freddie Swain. When Seattle drafted Freddie Swain, you know, a year ago or a year and a half ago now, I guess it is, you know, one of the things that I saw is a guy who struggled a little bit with consistency, and a lot of that had to do with the struggles at the quarterback position. Now, Kyle Trask wound up becoming a superstar for Florida this past year, but prior to that, Felipe Franks was their quarterback, and he was just so inconsistent with his accuracy that it was hard for any of the Florida wide receivers to play very well. The same thing at Florida State this year. The last couple of years, they have a quarterback there that is a better athlete than he is a passer, and I think that's a big reason why Tamori and Terry's numbers, were as inconsistent as they were, because you watch him on tape, and there's almost DK Metcalf-like flashes, and I don't mean that he is Metcalf's kind of talent, but in terms of his size, in terms of his straight line speed, in terms of his inability to change directions quite as quickly as a smaller man, but he does have power. He does have leaping ability. He does
can win contested catches.
Exactly. And all those things. And you think back to what Pete Carroll has always prioritized. He loves having those big wide receivers. You know, you got a superstar in Metcalf, but if something were to happen to him, Seattle is going to have another big receiver. Terry can be that kind of guy.
I think he's going to be one of the players that I've got circled going into training camp. Haven't gotten to see a lot of him so far in the OTA practices that I've watched. He missed a little bit of time at rookie minicamp as well. Again, durability is a question mark for this kid, but I will be watching him very closely, because this looks like this could be the next receiver that really blows up in preseason games. And I think the number 4, 5, and 6 slots for Seattle at receiver right now are pretty wide open. There are 5 or 6 players that could make a case for winning one of those spots right now. And so Terry, to me, is in that mix. If you can get the player from 2019, then he absolutely can make noise and maybe crack this 53-man roster. He's got that kind of talent. We'll just have to see what happens once training camp and the preseason gets here. Make sure to check out the Locked On Today podcast hosted by Peter Bukowski. Get all the sports news you need in under 20 minutes. Follow the Locked On Today podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get podcasts. You can follow me on Twitter at Corbin Smith NFL. You can follow Rob at Rob Rang. Check out Locked On Seahawks on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the all-new Odyssey app. That's AUDACY. Coming up on our Wednesday show, we're going to continue our countdown numbers 65 through 61, and we'll be checking out the tackle position as we continue our post-draft position-by-position review. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday. Go Hawks!